From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. The Smithsonian's new National Museum of African American History and Culture exhibits a stone once used as a slave auction block in Hagerstown. We'll discuss slave auctions of enslaved and free blacks in Western Maryland and the fissures still felt from these sales.
One of the things that happened when we were looking into this history is that some folks did refute that there were even slave auctions in Hagerstown.
Then, a civil rights activist discovers a bundle of papers tied with a ribbon. They turn out to be letters between her great-grandparents, written when they were courting in Reconstruction-era Baltimore. Maryland African-American history in stone and paper. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. After years of anticipation, the Smithsonian's new National Museum of African American History and Culture opened late last month. Among its thousands of artifacts are many connected to Maryland, including Harriet Tubman's shawl and hymn book, the house of a freed slave in Poolsville, a paper cutter from the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper. This morning, we'll zoom in on another of those artifacts, a stone slave auction block from Hagerstown. Our guest is Mary Elliott, a museum specialist at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. She helped research, conceptualize, and design the Slavery and Freedom exhibition at the museum, where the auction block is housed, and she joins us by phone. Mary Elliott, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So describe this stone block to us.
Well, the block, it's actually about 3 feet long, about 2 feet high, and it is made out of what would seem like a marble. And it was, we believe, to be outside the front of the courthouse for Washington County in Hagerstown, Maryland. We know that there were enslaved people sold by the sheriff in front of both the courthouse and at the yard in the jail.
How did you first hear about this slave block?
There was actually a gentleman who does artwork based on historic artifacts. And so he had been in Hagerstown, and he'd met a couple of people who told him about a gentleman who had an auction block. And this artist actually reached out to us and said, you guys should know about this gentleman. And so we followed up and had to do quite a bit of research to verify whether this was possibly an auction block or not.
I want to ask you about that. I want to clear up something first. I spoke the other day with an historian from the Washington County Free Library who said that property, and of course slaves were treated as property, was more typically sold from the courthouse steps.
Well, there are courthouses that had some auction blocks in front of them. It was typical to consider people being sold from the steps. So we had to do a lot of research to look at where people would have been sold from. So in Hagerstown, we know that people were sold from taverns, sold at hotel sites, sold at the courtyard, sold at the jail. And then we also looked into some of the narratives that people wrote, people who were sold from Hagerstown. One of the things that happened when we were looking into this history is that some folks did refute that there were even slave auctions in Hagerstown. But we know that, in fact, there were. And in the Washington County Library, Western Maryland Library collection there, they have quite a few articles from the period where they announce the slave auctions taking place at the courthouse and both at the jail. And those were conducted by the sheriff. It's our understanding that there was the auction block in front of the courthouse, and the materiality of this particular block matches the foundation of that courthouse.
I want to pick up on what you said about the advertisements in local papers that Western Maryland's Historical Library has collected. Let me read one from 1846, signed by the county sheriff. As you said, the sheriff conducted many of these sales. Quote, by virtue of an order of Washington County Court against John McDaniel and Catherine McDaniel, free Negroes, for coming into the state of Maryland contrary to an act of assembly of 1839, chapter 323, ordering them to be sold for fine and costs, I hereby give notice that on Saturday, the 26th day of December next, in front of the courthouse in Hagerstown, I will proceed to sell the said John and Catherine in conformity to the said act for cash. Close quote. This notice calls the McDaniels free Negroes. So, I mean, were they seized because they could not prove that they were free?
So this is important about the location of Hagerstown. Hagerstown is bordered by West Virginia and Pennsylvania, and you had African American men, women, and children who were fleeing from slavery and going through the state towards Pennsylvania. At one point, the sheriff was making so much profit off of accusing people of being fugitive enslaved, because remember, in that area too, there was also a large free community. At some point, the free community of color actually petitioned the government to remove the sheriff because he was making so much money off of accusing people of being enslaved and being fugitives. If they could not prove they were free, or if no one came to claim them, and I put that in quotes, then they would be sold.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Mary Elliott, a curator at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And we're talking about one of the artifacts in the new museum, a stone block, a slave auction block from Hagerstown. Tell us more about the role of Hagerstown. We think of course, New Orleans and the Deep South as having a lot of slave sales. Of course, there were dozens of slave traders operating in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
Also in Western Maryland?
Yes, in Western Maryland. So if you had the sheriff who was busy selling accused fugitive enslaved, that was a site where also you had people who advertised for being in search of a fugitive, right? Because that was such a narrow strip that was bordered between that West Virginia area and Pennsylvania area, and it was a site of a great deal of runaway activity. We talked with some of the folks at the Western Maryland Library, and they really gave us quite a bit of information to work from, but there is a series of articles written by a gentleman with the National Park Service, and he wrote about the disputed auction block. And one of the things that comes up is during the 1920s and 30s, you see people refuting that these objects are auction blocks. They were used to step up on a horse. But those same blocks that were used to step up on a horse were also used in many instances as auction blocks. There is, I believe it's in Fredericksburg, where a gentleman actually talks about being sold from the particular block. And then you pair that with the advertisements from the period. So it's an interesting thing to see people refute some of this history in plain sight, but understanding that some of that was because people didn't want slavery associated with their jurisdiction.
Well, let me ask you then in particular about a brass plaque, I think it's brass, a metal plaque of some sort on this block, that says that both Andrew Jackson and Henry Clay spoke from this block in 1830. I think that was during Andrew Jackson's presidency.
Mm-hmm.
Why would it have been that these two national figures would have been speaking in Hagerstown? And do you think that that plaque relates in any way to what you were just saying about other purposes being imputed to some auction blocks?
You can look at the block and focus on the plaque, or look at the block and understand the activity of what went on with the block in terms of slave auctions. We understand that Andrew Jackson did go through Hagerstown, Maryland during the period. I know he was in Hagerstown around 1829, 1830, as well as Henry Clay. From the news accounts during the period, Andrew Jackson was not met with a great deal of fanfare. But Henry Clay, in fact, was met with people who were interested in his arrival. And I understand that his wife was associated with the Hagerstown area and that he did, in fact, speak from the courthouse.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that your research took you into the narratives of some of the people who were sold. Is there a story that particularly stays with you?
There is one about a gentleman. His name was J.D. Green. While he was not sold from the courthouse, he was sold from the jail. And he spoke about what that experience was like. It was very interesting because he said that, and I'm paraphrasing, that he was carried to the jail and then carried down to the cells. There, he and others were inspected by a doctor, and then he said very distinctly that they were carried under the auction block. And then he talked about, you know, what the sale was like, and he specifically talked about the sale of a particular family and how a husband and wife and kids were torn apart from each other, and it was such a wrenching scene that when the wife was crying out for her husband and her children, she was actually killed by one of the people involved in the slave sale. And then this gentleman, this husband, turned around and killed one of the people involved with this sale. And so it's a very heart-wrenching scene.
Oh my.
What's also important about that is that in the African-American community in that Hagerstown area, specifically along that Jonathan Street part of Hagerstown, Jonathan Street is known as the historic black part of Hagerstown, we met with some of the folks who live there now, and they told us about all of the activity of the fugitive enslaved in that community, about the early free community of color, and about people being sold from the jail, and how that history had been refuted.
I imagine for every artifact that you researched and ultimately chose for the new museum, you wanted it to tell its own story, but also part of a larger story. What is the message of having this block of stone in the National Museum of African American History and Culture?
Well, I'm really glad you mentioned that because we say this is likely the auction block. Because we didn't find it in its original site, we have authenticated to the extent that we can do the provenance of it being associated with a family of stonemasons. The story is that one of the family members was charged with removing the auction block from the site of the courthouse and that it was passed down through the family over the years. What's important about this is the idea of how commonplace it was to sell African-American men, women, and children in public. The story of the fugitive enslaved who were seeking freedom regardless of the risk. The story of free African-Americans standing alongside their enslaved brothers and sisters to fight for their welfare and to ensure or to work towards freedom. But also it tells us a story about commerce and captivity, and it tells us the story about memory. That part on memory is very important because, as I mentioned, you have the residents of that historic Jonathan Street community who have been passed down the stories about the slave auctions associated with both the courthouse and with the jail, and they stood firm by that understanding. And yet you also have people who, they refute these memories, they refute this history, because they don't want it associated with their jurisdiction. So it's just a very important and powerful story.
Mary Elliott is a curator at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Thank you so much for sharing this history with us.
You're welcome. And may I just add, I have to say I am a co-curator, and my colleague, Dr. Nancy Burkaw, is the other co-curator, and it's been our pleasure to help bring this story to the American public, and we are so appreciative of all the powerful response to this new museum opening.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've got to take a quick break now, and when we're back, we'll talk about another artifact from Maryland's past, a trove of love letters between a black man and the black woman he was courting just a few years after the Civil War. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Right back.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome to On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Laura Murphy had been so busy with so many activities, including wrapping up her work as the first African-American to serve as director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, that she hadn't had time to completely go through a suitcase of family photos and mementos that had been given to her by her father's cousin nearly two decades ago. Then last year, she got to the bottom of the suitcase. Laura Murphy joins us on the line from Washington. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So tell me what you found in the suitcase.
Well, there had always been pictures and handwritten letters and playbills and concert tickets, but below all of this assorted memorabilia was a stack of letters tied with a tattered blue ribbon. And I had not paid much attention to them, and I saw that they had a date of 1871 and 1872 and 1873 on the different envelopes.
And what did they turn out to be?
They turned out to be letters of courtship between my great-grandparents, James Hughes and Mary Rebecca Lee.
I'd like to play a clip of you reading from one of the letters. It's been edited a bit.
My dear Mary, I will avail myself of this opportunity to write you a few lines. I read your kind and affectionate letter on Thursday last. I am very glad to see that you were so very happy. I was glad to hear that you arrived at your destination after getting lost. You are a very poor pioneer. Well, Mary, I'm feeling gloomy and lonely tonight. I feel as though I have roads to travel, but have but a few friends. But I trust I love one who will be a friend, and if so, that a love will be a bright light for me to walk with through everything, though everything else fails me. I trust I may not be laboring under a mistake. Please let me hear from you this week. Good night. Yours ever and truly, James.
And that was a letter that James wrote when?
October 28th, 1872.
And so they were courting in the 1870s. And where were they living? Why were they writing to each other as opposed to talking to each other?
James Hughes was born in 1848 in Halifax, Virginia. And sometime during his lifetime, he migrated to Baltimore. And he got various jobs as a caterer, and he was attempting to start a business. And Mary Rebecca Lee was born in Baltimore in 1847, and she was working in a place called Woodbury. It's now part of Baltimore City, but then it was an unincorporated area outside of Baltimore, and she was working as a helpmate and a seamstress for a woman who had a family of five children.
So what went through your mind when you found these letters?
It took me a while to figure out who they were, and then I figured out pretty quickly that those were my great-grandparents.
And what did it mean to you to be able to get this insight into their courting days?
I just thought it was fascinating. My father always talked about his grandparents, and he talked about them as well-to-do. When my father was born in 1917, both grandparents were still alive, and they had a booming catering business that my father worked in as a teenager. And he was able to see all of Baltimore, how the wealthy lived, and hear the gossip as he was in the kitchen and the people were talking about the clients being served. And he had a great deal of awe about his grandparents. He just thought that they were two of the most fabulous people that he ever knew. And Mary and James had five daughters, and one of those daughters was my grandmother, Grace. But the sisters were notorious. They were all married very well. They were very prosperous compared to the average African-American family because the catering business was doing so well, and Mr. Hughes gave his daughters allowances even after they married, so they all had their own money. So to get these letters and to hear them talk to each other when they had nothing, and when they were struggling to find a place to live, and he was worried whether or not he was well-born enough to marry her. I mean, this was just a fascinating insight because it was a side of them that I don't think my father even knew about.
Your family certainly is distinguished. Many of our listeners know of your brother, Billy Murphy, the defense lawyer and former judge. Your father was a Maryland District Court judge. Your mother was on WJZ-TV Square Off with Richard Scher, and your ancestors started the Afro-American newspaper. And you have a great aunt, an artist who's represented at the new National Museum of African-American History and Culture. Tell us about her.
That's on my mother's side of the family. Her name is Laura Wheeler Waring, and I'm named after her. I'm Laura Wheeler Murphy. And she was a portrait painter in the early to mid-20th century, and she won something called the Harmon Gold Medal, which allowed her to select African Americans of note to paint. And so she painted W.B. Du Bois and James Weldon Johnson, and she painted landscapes and all kinds of things, but she was known for her portraiture. There's a portrait in the new museum called The Girl in the Red Dress, and she looks like a femme fatale, this woman. She's a young woman with a red dress that's off the shoulders. The thing I love about my Aunt Laura's paintings is that she painted people with a great deal of dignity, and she was just in love with the various shades of African American. So from dark, dark skin to light, almost white skin, she could capture the red or the blue or the yellow undertones in complexions like nobody else I know. And I think the reason she's important is because African Americans during the early and mid-20th century often did not sit for portraits. And she felt it was important that African Americans be shown as people of stature, as people with education, people with dignity. And you can see a lot of her paintings at Cheney State College in Pennsylvania, where she taught for over 30 years. But the Smithsonian's now have a dozen of her paintings dispersed through the National Portrait Gallery, the New African American Museum, and other places.
Dignity. I've only read excerpts of a few of your great-grandparents' letters, but they seem very formal and very dignified. Where are the letters, and what are you doing with them?
I have the letters in a notebook that has plastic sleeves so that they will be protected. They're very delicate, and they have been probably folded and untouched for at least a century. And so when I opened them up to read them, I had to be very careful not to make sure that the paper didn't tear along the creases. I would like to write about these two individuals who worked themselves out of poverty, but I'd also like to research more about them. I want to know how 8 years after the Emancipation Proclamation and 6 years after the Civil War, two African Americans had such mastery of the English language used a sophisticated sentence structure and, you know, had an appreciation of social formalities. They were both born during slavery, but how did they get educated? That's what I want to know. Where did they learn to read and write? Were they descendants of freed blacks who existed at the time, or were they raised inside a home alongside white children and received the education along with them? Education was so crucial for the ability of African Americans to take advantage of their newly found freedom. This was a very, very hostile environment for African Americans. There was a period of Reconstruction, which, you know, gave certain rights, but they were quickly taken back by Jim Crow laws that undermined the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And so they flourished in a very short period of relative freedom, and then they established their business in a period of great hostility, of very harshly enforced segregation, where lynchings were commonplace. How they survived is interesting to me. So for now, I'm going to hold on to the letters, but eventually I would like to give them to the museum if they would have them, so that African Americans during the Victorian period, there can be a window into the lives of African Americans who were allowed to operate like this, who were educated like this, because that's just not the common image that you have of African Americans during the period.
I really appreciate your talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Laura W. Murphy. She is a fellow at Harvard University's Advanced Leadership Initiative. She found her great-grandparents courting love letters. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great day.